Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 108.
Sentioto. That's Portuguese. Do you know what I was just thinking about? I think I say every number, like episode, in the way that Google Translator says it. Like, she's like, Sendaioto. And I say it like that rather than trying to say it like a normal person.
Well, that's the easiest way to figure out what the pronunciation is.
It's probably terrible, but whatever. Yeah, but one more week, guys, till we go to basically Vermont to create this new circus show. I mean, it's exciting and scary and overwhelming and mostly exciting.
It's going to be awesome. Like, we've been listening to, we now have all the music, so we've listened to the show a couple times all the way through. It sounds so good. Book Kennison, Peter Bufano, my brother Jacob Avner are each composing or arranging tracks, and it doesn't sound like a show I've ever heard before, but it also sounds totally like our shows and super cool.
I always feel like there's this moment, like when you're making a show, like writing it before you start rehearsals, and you're talking through it and you've thought about it so much, and then you're like, is this all a piece of shit? And you're like, no, it's really good. And you're like, oh my God, but am I overthinking it? And there's always that moment of like, is this like ready? Are we ready to have people? And then you have moments like glimmers of like, oh my God, this is going to be fantastic. And those are like the saving grace, I think, when you get to like the moment right before rehearsal where you experience like the actual hard part of it and the like amazing payoff of seeing it actually come to fruition.
Well, you really see it come to fruition once the audience shows up. And I got to say, we've had tickets on sale now for a week and a half, and they're moving pretty quickly. Certainly at some of the sites, we have almost sold out shows already, saying sold out is like 400 people a show. So the fact that we already got up to that number in the first 10 days just goes to show how much pent up demand there is for local family friendly outdoor entertainment. Hopefully we keep this momentum going for the next month and a half, and really build up a nice big audience before we even have to do shows. I think it's interesting to look at the ticket data that we have for Stars Above, which is this outdoor show we haven't made yet, versus the ticket data for Babel, which is this indoor show that we have made, has opened, has great reviews, will reopen again at the end of September, and see if one will do better than the other. It's interesting. I am anxious reading the news about the Delta variant and how it's more transmissible, but maybe not more deadly or not necessarily worse if you get it, just more easy to get. And I don't know. I'm feeling very good about selling tickets to the outdoor shows and feeling nervous for the indoor ones.
Yeah, I think, there's a lot of different variables for reopening theater indoors this fall. What's interesting is Vegas has been open almost this entire time, and it seems to be going okay. The rest of the world seems to open, close. And I guess Vegas did open and close. But I don't know. It's making me really nervous about New York, especially since all these shows are opening at once. And now people are getting more and more nervous about going indoors. Like my mom, who's fully vaccinated, mentioned the other day that she was like, I really wanted to go buy Harry Potter tickets. But now I'm like unsure and kind of going to wait to see what happens with this Delta variant. And what's kind of like, I don't know, butting heads against the like, maybe we should cut back on capacity, all this stuff, is these SVOG grants, Shuttered Venue Operator Grants.
We've been talking about them since December of 2020.
I hate them, but I love them. Thank you for giving us money. But like, oh my God, we finally got our grant. I know a few other people who are our friends who listen to this podcast also finally received their grants. But what I think is absolute bull beep is that Waitress, Broadway musical Waitress closed on January 2nd, 2020. It closed of its own fruition. It did not close because of COVID. It closed
recouping 10 months into its run.
Yes. And it closed 2 months pre-COVID shutdown on March 12th. So how they got a $10 million payout for the Broadway show to reopen in September for 6 weeks? Is that how long?
No, it's going to be 4 weeks with Sarah Bareilles. And then I think it's a 4.5 month run.
Okay, so 4 weeks with Cerberus, whatever, 4.5 months. But like, what? Why? Why did you get $10 million? You already closed. You didn't close because of COVID. Why did you even apply? Why did you take money from other people that actually really needed to stay open? Like, it's just crazy to me. These Broadway shows that like don't actually need this money. They didn't actually lose any money. Like substantially, where like other businesses are like dying.
Well, this goes and closing. To like the stuff you and I talk about a bunch about like how government aid for the arts isn't just like a blanket good thing. And, you know, in the case of this, it's run by two producers, Barry and Fran Weisler, who will get to spend almost all of their expenses on the government dime. And then all of the profit they get to keep. And they're like millionaire billionaires from former Wall Street, you know, world. And it's essentially subsidizing them opening their show again after closing it. You know, and Hamilton, for example, got three $10 million payouts of $30 million. Three $10 million payouts in total, $30 million to like the highest grossing show of the last couple of years.
So Hamilton, and I understand sort of because the cast of Australia had to close. And so they're just like on furlough, essentially. So hopefully they're paying their actors. I mean, it's just so crazy.
They're not paying their actors. Everybody shuts down and then nobody is paid in Australia.
Right. So what's the $10 million? Like, what do you mean? And it's like, come on. I mean, I don't know. I just get like so frustrated by this whole thing.
I know you're frustrated. But one of the things that, you know, I think is interesting to point out is that you have to spend the money by the end of the year, which means all of the shows that take the money have to reopen before the end of 2021. Which is not what would normally happen in a natural market where people would time themselves out so that not everybody is opening at the same time and competing for, right, you know, different costume shops and scenic shops and personnel.
So Sarah Bareilles reopening Waitress September, whatever, and then, you know, going through December, they probably can pay all of the costs for the show with that $10 million grant, and then all of the ticket sales just go back to the investors, which like great,
which they've awesome. Already recouped. So
but they've already recouped, and then there's like $10 million of free just like running money that like could go to another show that was struggling or another venue, or like I don't know, it's all unfair. But isn't life unfair? And the U.S. is unfair. So que sera.
Que sera. Thank you, you know, U.S. government for the money you did give us. I will not say that it was that much, to be honest, but I'll, you know, we'll take whatever is available and be thankful for it.
Yeah, so thank you. But, you know,
going back to the Delta variant for one more minute, the shows in Australia are shutting down. I mean, we kind of passed over that just now, but Come From Away, Hamilton, both. I think there's a few more that go with that. Maybe Lion King, I think, as well. All had to shut down in Sydney because of a new COVID outbreak, and a large portion of the Australian populace isn't vaccinated yet. And, you know, now these shows have basically put all of their employees and everybody on hold with no pay. And the Australian government funds have not been paid out yet. In the UK and the West End, we've seen the same things. Open, close, open, close, open, close. You just referenced Vegas. I don't know if you can paint Vegas with like a super broad brush, because some companies like Spiegel World opened and then closed and then reopened. Well, Cirque du Soleil didn't reopen until like 2 weeks ago. They just reopened Mystère and O. They're going to do MJ next. I think we'd theorize that Mystère and O would be the first ones back, and talked about why Love, the Beatles show, wasn't the first one back due to the cost of the music rights. I saw Spiegel World just announced that they're going to be reopening Opium, which brings them fully back online by the middle or end of September, along with redoing the restaurant space that's attached to the Opium venue.
So, I wonder if when Absinthe, Atomic Saloon, and Opium, which are all three Spiegel World shows, if when all three are open and then a few of the Cirque shows are back online fully, if the demand will disperse more to other shows.
I think Vegas is so full of American tourists, and specifically American tourists who are not the types who are incredibly fearful of COVID, just to frame it that way, that Vegas and New York are going to have totally different problems, and that Vegas is probably a much safer place to be doing shows. They also don't have the level of cold weather, although they do have the crazy level of air conditioning.
That's true. That's true. But, you know, well, we'll see. But this is our sneaking in the podcast before we leave. We hope to keep doing them semi-regularly, although, you know,
It's not easy in creation.
No, I mean, when you're producing it and directing it and overseeing it all, and you have a year-old baby,
German Shepherd with you.
And cat.
Siberian cat.
It's a little much, but we'll try. And, you know.
We are doing a behind-the-scenes documentary with Aidan Gibney, who's this amazing filmmaker who made loads of our Beyond Babel behind-the-scenes material. We're going to release that sometime in mid-August. It'll be around 10 to 20 minutes in total, maybe one episode or a few episodes, but it will take you through the whole behind the scenes of our creation for the show. And then he'll be releasing a trailer, so people in August will be able to see visually what we're working on. And at some point during the run, we'll shoot the show for video. Whether or not we will release it this year, TBD, depending on how we're feeling about where the show's at and the video quality. We're also looking at putting the cast album on Spotify, which we may do in August. We may do a little later, depending on how long it takes to mix these songs to sound good. But I don't know. It's just the whole world's about to change for you and I. We've been living in this like COVID New York no shows. And in a week, we're going to be back to full on creation, 5 weeks of touring, 1 week of tech for Babel, 8 weeks of running. And then after Babel could extend past the initial 8 weeks that we've announced. We'll see what it is. And then in January, we're working on a new show with two former podcast guests, which if you follow these podcast guests, you might have seen little teases for on the internet. We can't say too much yet, but I think you and I are going to be really totally knees deep, hip deep, waist deep, shoulder deep. I don't know how deep, very
drowning
deep.
To our ears, or just our eyes can see. Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. It's been a year and a half, and I'm ready to get back to it and see what the new kind of vibe of life is like, and what the audiences are like, and what creating a show with a child is like. That's something we definitely have never done. And I'm excited to just get back to it.
And for those who missed our last episode, real quick, the show we're talking about is called Stars Above. It's a family-friendly outdoor open-air circus that sort of takes elements of the nostalgia we all have for 18th, 19th century circus, combined with what's cool about contemporary circus today, and tries to sort of merge them into one show. We'll be touring around Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and upstate New York from mid-August to mid-September. You can get your tickets at starsabovecircus.com. And then our hit dance show, Beyond Babel, which got two Drama Desk nominations and New York Times Critics Pick, will reopen in New York at the end of September. You can get your tickets to that at beyondbabelshow.com. Lindsay and I are almost always at those shows, so if you're a listener, come find us and say hello.
Well, on to our podcast guest today,
who is Stacy Clark, who's the new CEO of Circus Talk. We've been trying to get somebody on from Circus Talk, Andrea or Kim, for a little bit to talk about the platform. We use it a lot for both a news aggregator and for posting jobs and finding artists. And Stacy comes from a gymnastics background and then a Cirque du Soleil talent scout background, and is now really leading the charge for what the next phase of Circus Talk is.
First of all, Stacy is so well-spoken. The whole interview, I was like, I wish I could speak as well and eloquently as she does. She is such an interesting person to talk to because her background kind of like makes her the perfect person to be not updating Circus Talk's database, but rejiggering it. What'd you call it?
I think just taking it to the next level.
And her experience in casting and specifically acrobatic scouting, which I asked a million questions about because I was like, this is so interesting to me. But it really makes her understand like the needs for a casting database much more than the average person.
And she's got real world experience working for loads of different companies on various sides of the spectrum. So I think for those who are interested in, you know, what's the future of casting, future of online circus platforms. And she also does talk a little bit about her time at Cirque du Soleil and how the company changed. There's lots in this interview that I think folks will enjoy.
If you like our podcast, though, make sure to subscribe on iTunes Follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Follow along on Instagram for our Beyond Babel reboot and the new Stars Above. I'm posting on Instagram more than normal. I also have a Stars Above Instagram. I think it's Stars Above Circus, but I'm posting the same things on Hideaway, so you can follow along wherever your heart desires.
Without further ado, here is our interview with Stacey.
Stacey, thank you so much for coming on our podcast. I'm thrilled to chat with you. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
I am just outside Montreal in Canada.
And are you Canadian originally?
I am indeed. Born and raised in Montreal, as a matter of fact.
So did you see like Cirque du Soleil blossoming as a kid? Were you like involved in the circus world or were you into other things?
Well, I was a gymnast, actually. And yes, indeed, I do have memories of Cirque du Soleil being down in the old port from when I was a youngster-ish. And curiously, maybe even, well, serendipitously, who knows, I sort of missed the boat on that. I was an athlete, and then I went away to university. And then in that window of time, a lot of people I knew from sport had started to be snatched up by Cirque du Soleil in those sort of early days of like really starting from scratch with house troupe development. So long story short, yes, I did get to see them down in the old port, and then fast forward many, many, many years. And that's where my actual connection began.
What kind of gymnastics did you do? We've actually had a lot of prior gymnasts. I'm still waking up. Prior gymnasts on the show, and you know, a lot of rhythmic gymnasts. But what was your kind of gymnastic experience?
I was an artistic gymnast, so I was the traditional sort of four apparatus all rounder. And yeah, that was a really big part. I still hold it very close to me. It was a significant defining piece of my life, actually, that sort of ended up coming full circle.
What ended the gymnastics career, though? What, I mean, but I think gymnasts, I think like now, like 14 or 15 year old girls are the people who go to Olympics. So it doesn't exactly have the longest like shelf life as a sport goes.
And I have to say, in my window, which was the early 80s, mid 80s, that was particularly true. There's actually been tremendous change in that space where the gymnasts are now very much women as compared to back in a period of time when we were all still girls. In my case, I was having recurring issues with my back, and it really became evident that my body was just not going to keep up with the level that I was at. And so I had to make a change. I didn't want to be that person in pain all the time. So there it is. I redirected, and yet how significant that it became so important for me later in life when I actually first joined Cirque du Soleil as a talent scout. My principal scouting discipline was gymnastics. It was in my blood.
Yeah, well, I guess you know like what to look for, you know, like the shapes, the form. One of our family friends, she's a judge for elite gymnastic competitions. Mm-hmm. And you know, we watch it with her and I'm like, oh, that was so good. And she's like, well, you know, the toe was a little out. And I'm like, okay, you know, the detail of it all. But so what did you go to college for? What did you study?
Media arts.
That's an interest.
What does that mean?
I know, right? What it means today is not what it meant then. That's the other big issue, that the it's exploded. Like I'm not of the digital era. I'm just visiting. So media arts, principally photography and film with communications being a big driver as well, and art history. So I'd always had this kind of parallel like artistic bent or creative bent that was manifesting itself in a certain way, separate from sport. Where that brought me, and it's a total Flashdance story, which I can summarize quickly. I graduated university and I went on to work in the arts-ish, in that I was working in communications, but for arts organizations and arts groups. So I always kept that really close. And then I discovered flying trapeze at the ripe old age of 26. And that was sort of the beginning of the end. I took a total diversion and luckily was working at an ad agency, a marketing agency that had a leader who had been a musician, my boss had been a musician and really supported this notion of, you know what, it's now or never, like, go do this. And so my professional career, which had been, you know, full of its own little chapters, was put to the side and I dove into performing. And so for a while there, I was doing both, like literally the work by day, perform at night, until that was untenable. And it was like, let's do this. Let's just go and perform.
And when you say perform, you're talking about performing flying trapeze?
Well, that was my point of entry, but actually I became more of a generalist aerialist. So my thing was static and duo trapeze, and I performed hoop a fair bit as well. So really it was a little bit of, you know, the way many aerialists sort of touch on things. I was a bit of a hard apparatus type, more so than tissue and rope, for example. But yeah, that was what I took both into street performing and then into festival work and then into stunt work and then into, you know, circus, actually.
I'm sure we'll talk about this more when we get to talking about doing casting for acrobats. But I'm wondering if you could talk like your own personal experience going from something that's a competitive expression, often with like set music, not when you get to the highest levels, but at like the medium levels, sometimes you don't even pick your music and it's for a judge, versus now doing something that's meant to maybe have more of an artistic bent, less of a competitive bent, something for an audience. Like, how did that sort of like ripple with you as experiencing that?
It's so significant. And there's two sides to this coin. I had a really decent gap between the two. So I didn't bring a lot of baggage with me into circus. I really brought muscle memory and what was in my body more so than anything that was too rigorously instilled in, you know, follow the rules or do things a certain way for the outside eye. That said, developing creativity is a skill unto itself. And what I have actually learned from that experience firsthand is how much having a voice and offering agency when teaching, when coaching, is so crucially important to help hone those skills early. So yes, gymnastics works within the code of points and it works with a very specific objective. You're there to get a score. Whether you get that through touching people and impacting them in an emotional way doesn't always matter. It's a super nice to have, and some athletes are amazing at it, but it's not actually necessarily rewarded in the way that it is when you're a professional artist and you're more or less there on stage to do just that. It transcends you. It's not about you anymore. It's about your audience, and it's about making that connection with them. So it's a skill to be trained. There's the advantage of having, I think, the solid foundation and the discipline and all the amazing things that sport teaches you. And then there's that sense of, okay, like Picasso, you know, we can paint realism. Let's drop that now and go into something else. And ooh, look, we created cubism. Like, we need to use the foundation and then forget it.
It seems like one of the common themes when we talk to people who have street performance backgrounds is the ability to connect with an audience quickly. And, you know, that most of what they learned is from street performing, and that's like where they really cut their teeth and learned. And you mentioned you did that. And then also hearing your transition from, you know, gymnastics, where the audience doesn't really matter. And then you realize like, oh, they, you know, for performance, it's like all about the connection. How was street performing for you?
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was super naive going in. I worked in a duo, and we were like the heaviest loaded street performers in the world. We had two large road cases out of which we popped a portable freestanding aerial rig. Ridiculous, but it worked. And we did this in a lot of amazing places in front of a lot of amazing people. What it taught me is how to earn what you get. Literally from the money in your hat to the applause, to the exchange with people afterwards, to the little kids coming up who want your signature, to the moms who are like, oh my God, I can't even do a pull-up. Like, how do you do that? Because let's face it, we weren't that young at this point. Like I was in my 30s already. And I loved it. It was gratifying because anytime you get anything, you've earned it.
Yeah, certainly on the street. No major drama though in this reformer career. Nothing where you're like anyone trying to shut you down or prevent you from from putting up that aerial rig or any of that along the way.
Always like, you know, you have to be a little careful, and you're right. Like, you learn to read your audience. We had a lot of audience interaction built into our show. And so we had one or two mishaps where it was maybe not the best choice to pull that particular person in, not having observed that he's got a few empty cans at his feet and, you know, may not be that stable anymore. Always like some fun stories. We were so lucky though, not to have anything traumatic or dramatic. It was much more just like, oh, this will go into the history books as a weird thing that happened to us. It's almost like what weird thing didn't happen to us, actually, if I reflect on that chapter of my life, but all in the safety of a really beautiful community of street performers who at the end of the day really respect one another. And I think are just there to look out for one another.
So you mentioned you did stunt performing, and I was like, what? That's so cool. I want to hear more about that chapter and kind of how you got into it and what you did. And mm-hmm. I saw a few movie credits that I want to ask about.
Yeah. My stunt work was very, it was a sort of a, I don't know how I fell into it. Honestly, it's one of those things where if I could go back and like do this differently and better and actually plan it, I would love to train myself into that space, the way stunt performers work so hard to succeed. But again, it sort of fell into my lap with a couple of great opportunities that sort of lead to other little opportunities. It's like the circus community in that way. It starts to become a lot about your network and who you know. And that's really fun. Like it has this sort of certain glamour to it, and yet it is exactly not that at all. You literally sit around for hours and hours and hours. And then when it's time to go, inevitably, like you're in the toilet or you've just eaten at the catering truck and you're like, oh God, I do not feel like doing that right now. Or, you know, you're sort of needing to warm up for like the 15th time and the body's starting to complain a little bit. That was my personal experience anyway. So loved it and met some amazing people doing it. I always had stuff that was circus related. Like I was brought in because I could be the stunt double to do a circusy thing. One of my big takeaways was doing a silk strap. I mentioned I wasn't I wasn't a regular tissue performer. I just had a collection of skills that I was really comfortable with, one of which was a really nice drop. But of course, when you control everything yourself, you figure out your own costume and you figure out how that works. And then, you know, physics kicks in and the law of friction. And wow, the costume combined with the tissue and the fact that I had to repeatedly do this drop, like again and again in this tiny little window, that led to a very bad burn. And any tissue artist knows what that feels like. Well, actually, any circus artist knows what pain feels like. That I will never forget. That was gruesome. Just part of the job.
Yeah, we've also heard a good amount of stories about people who wear costumes and then do the same trick over and over and over again in a costume, and how that can lead to injury or, you know, other unpleasant things. How did the transition for you go from wanting to be a performer to wanting to be on the other side of that equation, both from like a practical perspective, but also from like an internal, like emotional, motivational kind of perspective?
What a beautiful question. The practical piece came first. It was time to hang up the tights. I was ready to go back into something that was a little bit more long-term oriented. I don't want to say necessarily secure. I was a street performer for a decade, so I had sort of given that up. But I was looking ahead. I was ready to go back, and I really wanted to get back into that marriage of body and brain and really putting my more strategic thinking self into a challenging space. The way things were at the time, I was working with a fantastic company in Calgary, Alberta, Greenfields Theater. They're a physical theater company. And I had a summons back to Montreal. I knew it was time to go back. There was some family needs, and I was really feeling the call. And lo and behold, there was a job posting for a talent scout at Cirque du Soleil. So, you know, this is now like two decades later, and I had migrated into the circus industry, but not with Cirque du Soleil in mind, really. Not, in fact, not at all at the time. I was completely in a different genre, and I was creating and doing my own thing. But it seemed such an interesting opportunity. And I happened to have a gig in Quebec City at the same time. So I was able to work out my first interview so that I could actually meet them, get a tour of the space, and everything just aligned. The marketing background and communications background combined with the gymnastics, combined with my own circus experience, it all just seemed to be, I was at the intersection of Cirque du Soleil Talent Scout, basically. And after three interviews, I was selected to join the team. I was a little trepidatious because I'd not used my French in a long time and I was rusty. So I just sort of dove in and faked it till I made it. And then here we are 14 years later.
So what is like a day or a week in the life of a talent scout? And then and part B to that question is, you know, from my experience doing a little bit of casting for Spiegelworld prior to doing our own thing, is you're like the first face that people often meet for the company. But then you, when they're actually working for the company and things are going sideways or not perfect, you can't really help them because that's not your role. Your role is sort of to get them in the door. So maybe you could speak a little bit to what the job is like and sort of managing that.
Absolutely. So the talent scout in the context of this company, Cirque du Soleil, where I was a talent scout, we were responsible for developing relationships in our respective areas. And I say we because it's quite a large team covering a lot of disciplines, specialists in dance and clowning and acting and puppeteering and all the acrobatic genres. So we had each of us sort of a portfolio of principal disciplines for which we were responsible. In field, that meant covering competitions, absolutely being the front-facing ambassador to the company at the casting level. So talking with coaches, talking with athletes who are considering a conversion, being present at all of the important school presentations, essentially being that sort of quiet cheerleader saying, hey, there's a career opportunity here for you. And also being the bearer of bad news a lot of the time. We were dream crushers at the same time. And it was that fine balance of going out into the communities, the very varied communities, some being a little more receptive than others, and trying to encourage people to consider when the time was right for them to take a look at this as an option for another chapter of their performing career. So that meant travel. That meant also a lot of work on the computer and keeping files up to date and keeping in contact with people. And slowly but surely, things like Facebook crept into the portrait, where that level of communication became important, making sure that we had a presence, that we were known and appreciated and respected and trusted. It also meant hosting auditions, of course. And so that was the talent scout portion of things. But to your point, the part two-ish, what's really tricky about it, and I have to say I loved being a talent scout. I always did, even as my positions changed a little bit within the company, I really, really enjoyed that. And I believed in it. Where it becomes difficult often is that we are a service to the creators. And as you would have experienced, perhaps the final decision is often that of the creation team or creative collection of people. So we don't always have, we're sort of a little bit powerless at a certain point in that journey because we've done everything we can to put the best, most interesting candidates in front of the creators. And then the choice is made by somebody else. And then additionally, once you're actually sort of in that machine, one of the most important things for me was to actually maintain a positive relationship with the artists, the candidates who became artists within that company, not because I could take care of them, not because they needed to be taken care of by me, but because it was important and meaningful for me to follow their career a little bit and grow respect, but also feel proud of being a part of that journey that they had embarked on.
One thing I want to ask about specifically the acrobatic casting. Well, one's like kind of a piece of trivia and then one's a question, but I'm reading this book called Traveling Showman, which is about circus in America in the 1800s and the 1900s. And one of the things they talk about is that the Olympics didn't start up again until like the late 19th century or so. So people considered circus performers as essentially Olympians, even though that word wasn't like in the American lingo. And now you're pulling from people or circus pulling people who are literally Olympians, which is kind of a neat full circle thing. But there's obviously like a big jump. If you're doing casting for circus performers and you're like, okay, we need flying trapeze artists and you're going to Mexico and you're finding a flying trapeze artist, a little bit of a different thing than finding a gymnast who you're convincing to switch career to put on this makeup, move to Las Vegas, go on the road, whatever it is. Was there anything that you would say is like, these are the kind of like personality characteristics that generally make somebody succeed in that transition or not succeed in that transition?
I would think that I can come up with some human qualities and attributes that probably even extend beyond succeeding within circus. It's just how to be a good human being. But more specifically, yes. First, our job actually was not to convince people so much as to let them convince themselves. It's not for everyone. There are some tremendous people, both in the world of circus performing and in high performance sport, who have no interest in working for certain kinds of companies. They're very happy where they are doing what they do and how they do it. Others perhaps just never had thought of it. And so that would be our job to at least inform and educate and help them be able to make educated decisions about whether this is the right place for them. I often talk about fit. And for me, what fit means is the person, the human, and then the context in which they're going to work. Is this a match? And so a lot of it is just being, I think, a learner, a constant learner, a generous person, someone who's coachable, that goes the distance. That's where athletes are tremendous because they come in knowing how to be coached. On the flip side, sometimes you have to work a little harder to have them also evolve out of that model, because so much of it really then needs to become about their own self-discipline and their own self-regulation. But as a starting point, it's tremendous. They are usually selected because they're incredibly technically proficient, super duper consistent, and understand the physical practice of what circus arts is. Also coming in with a lot of discipline and usually a lot of focus. It's so interesting you use those two examples, because the other big piece of scouting, if we talk about Latin America, for example, or just, you know, any different geographical regions in the world, a lot of it is reading the room. There's so much around culture. And we used to joke in casting, like we get these sort of excuses of a resume, which I'm just thinking like, did no one ever teach you how to make a resume? Like we need this to help generate a contract offer for you. But coming from certain parts of the world, no, in fact, the answer is they had not been taught how to make a resume. They had no idea how to do it. It had never been part of their landscape previously. So why should they know how to do that? Read the room, figure out how you can empower that person and how we can extract the best from them in order to be able to consider them and present them to the final decision makers. Different from someone who for example, comes through a more formal institution who does get that training. Like they know they've chosen circus already and they have followed the education path to get there. So the attributes that are common are really about who that human is. After that, it's about, you know, like they say about communication, adjust your style to be able to best communicate with the person in front of you. We had to go in and understand that we are now in a different space. And so what's my message? It has to be tailored.
When you would be scouting for acrobatic acts, and people, where would you typically go? Is it like you'd go see gymnastic competitions? Would you go see families in other circuses? Like, what is the kind of genre of people that you would go see?
Me personally, it definitely was more sport-based with a pretty nice sprinkling of circus, usually like the acrobatic components of circus. And that did mean competition. So for example, there would be significant championships and significant milestone competitions in different parts of the world, depending on the specific discipline. And we would have arrangements with the federations or the organizing body to be able to have a presence, to be able to come into that space and see what the trends were happening in that particular cycle, who might be approaching retirement, you know, meet in the hotel lobby with a coach or two to be able to get an understanding of who they felt might be an interesting candidate for a future career. Very much the competition circuit as it relates to sport. After that, it would be covering festivals. It would be making sure that we had a presence at different show presentations whenever that was possible. The harsh reality / positive advances in technology meant that the physical presence was actually lessening and our digital connection was becoming more enhanced. And I think that's pretty much true of where we are today, just in general in life. But it was a necessary evil. It's a shame because I love doing things in person. I love, one of my favorite things was hosting auditions and actually getting to exchange and be with artists and be with athletes and encourage them through the day. A lot of times that has to happen now via demo evaluation and maybe a Zoom meeting or a virtual audition. It's just where we are in the world. I'm a bit old school in that way because I really loved being in the field.
Well, you're setting us up for a great transition into your new role. But before we get there, I'm going to ask you one question that's kind of hard to answer for people who've worked for Cirque du Soleil. So I get it if you need to be PC about it. But is there any way in which you would describe the changes you saw culturally at the company or even practically over your time there, like going from Guy to TPG now to new ownership? Like, are there any through lines at the company that you would like pull from or notice?
All right. I will not answer that in a reactive manner. I will maybe preface it by saying that I'm no longer employed. I think that's evident. Like so many people, unfortunately, I was laid off when the pandemic struck. And so I am now looking back over my 14 years. Yes, there were absolutely trends. I actually joined the company in what I would consider just post heyday. Any of the crazy stories, probably many of which are true, were already sort of tempered. And, you know, we were already a very real business when I joined the company. And then perhaps I don't want this to be overly PC. I have nothing but fond memories, and I had a tremendous career at Cirque du Soleil. I'm grateful for all of it. Change happened. It was observed from the outside. It was felt on the inside. It changed. It had to change. So I don't knock that. Intellectually, I think a lot of us knew that things had to change. How it changed? Well, it wasn't ours to mess with. Did I like it? Not all of it. I can absolutely say that there's a lot of things I did not like, but what I loved were the people that I worked with directly, the people in my orbit, the people that were part of the artist pathway to bring people, talent into the company. And then ultimately, pardon me, I'm not verklempt. It's really just sticky throat. You know, following the artist to their hopefully long career on stage, that entire space that I turned in was full of really amazing people. So when there were things happening that I personally didn't either understand or even just like, my choice was to dive in deeper to the pieces that were within my control and the really terrific people that I got to work with. And that kept it a very happy and safe place for me.
Well, answered as far as not saying anything too bad. But
Wait, one question. What was that thing we were watching last night that was like a sport, a dance on the floor of a gymnast?
Oh, it's called aerobic gymnastics. Do you know this genre?
I do.
Oh, my God.
It was just on the Olympic Channel last night as we were surfing through it.
What did you think of it?
We were underwhelmed by the performance. I believe it was Finland, maybe. It was a Scandinavian country who was competing when we tuned in. But
it's interesting. It's not really so dance. It's not really so sport. It's like a little middle ground. But when you were talking about going to scouting stuff, that's in my head.
We actually have, just off the top of my head, I can think of two artists, both extraordinary, who come from that discipline. It's a little less common because, as you'll notice, like doing a push-up with one arm or one leg over your shoulder to the beat, you know, Jane Fonda-esque, not exactly the what we're looking to transfer on stage in a Cirque du Soleil creation. However, what I learned about that sport was that it was for some people, a transition away from a higher intensity sport like artistic, because they already had the physical wherewithal and so many terrific abilities and skills. And then they could channel it into this more elevated fitness space. So yeah, two people who turned out to be tremendous artists, like, and I say artists with the most respect, creators, very, very rich in their artistic expression, come from that place. It's a little less known in North America. You know, it's definitely something that has a slightly more popular life in European countries.
Mm. Okay, I want to hear now a little bit, because I do think we're going to keep talking about casting in one way or another, about your new role at Circus Talk, how that came to be, and what the role is in particular.
Yeah. So I'm delighted to be on the team now with Circus Talk. And here's how this went down. When the pandemic hit and I found myself, like so many other people, sort of in that space of what? Like, what even just happened? There is that, you know, all the stages of grief, all the normal stuff that we went through. But a few months in, start of the summer last year, it became evident that there was actually, this was not going to go away anytime soon. And we really recognized within the community, sort of peer-to-peer, or just through the friendships and the contacts that we had, that a lot of people were struggling. Really, really struggling. Like, it was that first low dip that I think a lot of people went through. And so together with a small collection of former colleagues, I formed a little project called Projet Lumière, Lumière Project, Lumière meaning light. And that idea was simply to create sort of a zone that people could go to. And it was very basic, something that we wanted to be for the community, by the community. Here's a space, here's a safe space to come and chat, et cetera. Facebook group, get a little bit of PR happening, make sure people know that you're being thought of. We've all had been sort of separated and we've all gone home and we're miles apart and we don't all have great living situations, but we're all here. And so I had reached out to Circus Talk, and of course I knew of them through my work at Cirque du Soleil. But when you work in the role that I was in, especially at that company, I had my goggles on. I had a job to do and I had a really clear mandate. So I didn't actually have a lot of space to be invested and involved in lots of other places. So this is a really great opportunity for me to connect with them and just reach out and say, hey, I've written an article, is what it was. I'd actually written an article about transferable skills. And, you know, is this something you're interested in? Can we talk about a little collab? And they were super open and really lovely and very on the pulse of what was happening with COVID and the impacts of it in the performing arts and circus industry. One thing led to another. We stayed in touch. I started to just sort of do little projects with them that led to the inception of the web series that I'm still doing. We're just about to put the third episode out. And it led to a research project. And this is the sort of TSN turning point, because
the idea was to step into conversations around a strategic reorientation, a lot influenced by the post-pandemic what's next, but also very much like the ready state for bringing this platform into a space that would have the very far-reaching international tentacles that it deserves to have. It's a platform for good. And I know I'm going to sound a little preachy because like I've been there for 5 seconds and of course I'm going to say great things, but I wouldn't be there if I didn't genuinely believe in the potential and the value of what this platform can offer the circus community. So our relationship grew. We just got to know one another. I had the privilege of working with the team on different little initiatives. And as the strategic vision became more clear, the role was created that I could step in and join them more permanently for the long term, with a particular focus on enhancing the casting portion of the platform. So we're talking now about the optimization of a talent database, which our goal is to make it the destination within the circus arts for performers of all stripes and the destination for talent seekers. We're basically the hub where we can make those connections happen. So that's the single biggest part of my mandate. And the rest will be wherever I can contribute as someone who has, I guess, had my hand in a handful of different kinds of genres, still tons to learn and so much more to be exposed to. I fully acknowledge that. But I'll step into this basically as an ambassador and a front-facing individual, a little bit like my infield work as a scout, where I will get to go and be representing the company and looking at the very best way that we can bring people together through the platform.
When I first moved to New York, I was an actor for musical theater, and I had an agent and everything, and the agent was like, you know, you have to put yourself up on the Actors Access, and that's like the database where all these people look, and you know, that's where we get contacted. And I hated it because like the interface was so bad. I was like, I'm filming myself doing this monologue and singing, and I'm, you know, like it's so much nicer in the room and all this stuff. And, you know, doing casting for our circus show this summer has been interesting because again, it's been all online. And then like, how do you continue the connection with an artist? Because there is something about connecting with an artist on a personal level, and maybe they're not the best for the role, but they're an amazing person that you want to work with, you know, and how do you not lose that with a database, which is so important, but then like also have it feel like personal with the people who are trying to cast for the show, I guess.
You've touched on the essence of casting. And here's two really important takeaways from this research project. The first was that unequivocally, all the talent seekers with whom I spoke agree that the personal connection is crucial. It's imperative that there be something in that to support what I touched on earlier, which is the fit, the human being able to play with the people in this sandbox in a way that is going to be beneficial for everybody. And yet, it's a big world. We've now experienced firsthand that we can't always go where we want when we want. And even if we can, let's face it, who's got the budget for it, really? And maybe there's a third prong here, which is around a very big subject that I am not an expert in, but it's the concept of diversity within circus arts. It is so important to know your network, but it's so important to grow your network. And I think where we step in is the latter, helping creators, talent seekers grow their network through this first point of contact, which is technology as a tool. It's technology to support. I don't love the idea that technology is doing the job. I don't actually believe in that. You know, I mentioned I'm a little old school, but I think in the best way. The personal connection is so important. Knowing the human, you have to work and live and create with these people. You need to know who's behind the artist. And yet we also don't necessarily want to just get into a recycling mode where we sort of go to the lowest hanging fruit because you live in my backyard and we already know each other. And then there it is, it's done. There's so much talent all over the world. And we're trying to create, I think, a little bit more democratic approach to accessing that talent and allowing the spotlight to be shone in different corners of the world so that talent seekers can use it as the catalyst for then stepping into the personal relationship development piece.
So, I mean, I can certainly validate the fact that it's a very useful tool. Lindsay and I paid Circus Talk, you know, to promote our casting for like nearly 2 months while we were doing it on their regular email blasts. While I have you here, I feel like something that could be worked on is the search function, because that to me, I think is... in trying to use it as a database, as opposed to a way for people to submit to our database, it was just a little clunky, at least back in November. I'm sure you guys are doing all kinds of things behind the scenes to improve it. But within the search function, what I noticed is that, like, and you kind of touched on this earlier, is how do you get people to apply to it who don't make resumes? You know, like, how do you get the circus artists who aren't the people, like, okay, so you come out of circus school, ENC, Quebec, Circadium, NECA, wherever, and they're like, okay, before you graduate your last semester, let's make you your Circus Talk profile. Let's make you your website. Let's make you this and that. But how do you get the people who aren't already inclined to apply to it? And so that's like the bottom level of entry. And then for people who are like working all of the time, you know, who maybe you can afford them and you would offer it to them, but you just don't have them. How do you get that person who feels like they don't need, you know, to be in a database to get on there? So that's like how do you get those two directions, or how are you guys thinking about that, even if you haven't solved it yet?
I'm thrilled that you are addressing this because you've nailed it. This is a huge part of my mandate. There are absolutely enhancements and optimizations on the way to make this what it needs to be as that very tool that will serve someone like you as a talent seeker, and ideally also make the user experience actually very accessible to the talent themselves. Addressing then the second piece of it, which is, so one of the things that we've got clear in our minds is the why. We've done a lot of work on the why, and we are knee deep in the how right now, because you're absolutely right, to make this what it needs to be, it has to serve a lot of people and it has to serve a lot of different needs, but fundamental to it is also a certain type of consumer behavior adoption. Start using it, give us that feedback, and we'll continue to make it serve you in the way that you need. That is going to take a little bit of time. It's also going to take simply the proof, getting people just like you into that space when the enhancements are active and made available fully, to be able to get in there and say, oh yeah, okay, now I see what's happening here. Like, this really gets me into the spaces I need, and I can mine down into that exact type of talent I'm looking for. Ooh, and it can also bring me those wild cards that I didn't know I was looking for, because I've put in the right kind of criteria. And, you know, yay, technology, not my thing, but it's going to pull all together all of that information and make it really easy for you to manage. There's going to be all kinds of bells and whistles, basically, that let you arrange and organize your casting process in support of what will then become the phone call that you choose to make, or the Zoom call, or the perhaps live audition, or perhaps virtual audition, whatever your exact mechanism is. So yes, work to do, but very clear on why we're doing it. As it relates to the attraction factor, for me, that is two significant things off the top of my head. One is education, being available to inform and support and let people know that it is achievable, accessible. In fact, maybe you don't need to have the perfect resume if all the prompts are there and it's information that you can plug in. So that is, of course, the joy of being in 2021, because the technology gods have made these tools available. After that,
careful calling them gods.
Yeah, I know, right? Like they need it. Like they need any larger heads. Although I have to say, I throw a lot of respect down that path because it's. I only like the results. I don't like getting into the weeds of it. It's just not where my brain goes. I'm a little numerically challenged at the best of times. But what I can do is conceptualize and strategize. And so I just like to know it's done and someone else can do it really, really well. And then, you know, then I go back to the why. Why do we need that? Okay, now I'm in. So yes, we will be able to hopefully make it something that is accessible. And it's a bit chicken and egg, right? It has to be accessible, but in so doing, there also needs to be proof and results. Like the talent needs to know, why am I bothering? And the talent seekers need to know that if they go in there, they're going to find what they need because the talent has in fact bothered to go and do what they need to do. The amount of people who, and I say this after 14 years of evaluation, who still don't necessarily know the difference between a sizzler reel and a demo application, education. I'm quite happy to share the gospel and tell you what it is that talent seekers are looking for. So it's just going to be, we're just going to need to be patient and very proactive and also very strategic to do things in the right order so that we're really finding ourselves in that perfect sort of harmony of the talent is there and they're chomping at the bit for work. And the talent seekers know that if they go there, they can do efficient work and get a great result.
Yeah. I mean, you've led into something I would have suggested, which is that the reason I go to Circus Talk the most is for the news page, which I have always advocated to Andrea and Kim, which I'm sure they're listening, to put more on the front page and less hidden. Cause that's my first stop, is to be like, okay, what's the latest? And then you're basically serving like classifieds, you know, using old school newspaper terminology against the news. One thing, and you sort of touched on this a little bit, but I think is like a greater trend is like online certifications for things, as opposed to needing like a degree or a diploma or some kind of thing, which is certainly the case for circuits, right? Because you could juggle in your room by yourself for 5 years and come out and have the craziest technique and not have seen anybody and learned it all on the internet. Not for all skills, certainly not for something like teeter board, but you know, for some things you can do it in isolation. So I guess, are you guys thinking about, when you're talking about like development things, like teaching you what a sizzle reel is, how far does that extend in your mind past just like, here's how you can use our database to here's how we can be like a proper educational platform?
You are perfectly segueing into our growth plan. So thank you. Well, a lot of the pro content is in fact going to be with that bigger picture in mind. And I use education as an overarching sort of career development, career focus umbrella. But within that, there will be absolutely content that is put in place to fill the needs. One of the things we're working really hard on is identifying the needs, understanding that those needs vary a great deal. But nevertheless, there's a lot of commonality that we can pull from, and we're going to look at enhancing all that content to be able to let people get onto that playing field. Doesn't mean everybody has to do it the same way, but it's so arbitrary in some spaces right now that I think there is a space for it. And I want to give a ton of respect to all the higher institutions and the formal education environments and those choices that artists make, that students make. But there are equally a great deal of other spaces, including the self-taught pathway or personal coach pathway, that can have a lot of value. And those pathways tend to have bigger gaps. That those are the people that need to step in and say, it's true, I don't treat myself as a business. You know, I'm an artist, I do what I do and I love it. But there's a lot of stuff that I need to do better if I'm actually going to get work, if I'm going to learn how to market myself, if I'm going to package myself in a way that a talent seeker can properly interpret and digest and understand my very best strengths. So there will be content essentially with the idea that, like your user journey. When you step into the new space, which I think is another really important part of the education, figure out what's happening around the world. Pay attention, be influenced, be inspired, contribute to that. That's what's going to make the circus community even more amazing than it is. I mean, that's really what it is. We just want to continue to enhance that. And then from there, take a look at all this different content and figure out, okay, what's in here that suits where I'm at in my professional development.
Hey, one last question about future features, and then I'll get off of that. So would you guys ever do something, since you clearly have an unbelievable amount of casting experience, where you would offer like casting pro, where I'm like hiring you or somebody in your office who's actually seeing all of the data behind just what's on the screen to be like a person helping with casting through Circus Talk, as opposed to just a database? Or do you guys see yourself just as like a platform and not a service in that kind of way?
We've been talking a lot about that marriage and the distinction between tool and service. So what I would say to that, because it's a little early days yet, is that don't rule anything out. We know already that the two significant criteria, this two kind of building block components of casting, is the technological support, whatever that collection of tools is, and the personal connection. So it stands to reason that when you get those two things happening together, that's going to give you the most fruitful results. And that's what we have our eye on.
All righty. Well, we'll see what happens. We'll have our eye on it.
Well, I was just thinking about how, when we were in grad school, part of the weekly quiz that we'd have every Monday was like, you'd have to have read the news every day that week. Like from all the outlets, and then you'd be quizzed on it starting like that Monday.
News.
Yeah. Entertainment, you know, specifically theater. And I was like, that would be fun if Circus Talk had like a Monday quiz. Like
the New York Times does that. They have the New York Times, you scroll down, it's like, have you been following the news this week? And you answer it. They're like, you did better than 40% of people, or you did worse than, you know, however this many people.
Good, because then you like remember, you know, what happened.
You gamify it, right? Everybody loves things being gamified.
Exactly. I love this. You're now the official new additions to the advisory panel.
Yeah, great. It's anytime.
Yeah.
Speaking of advisory panels and advice, it's a perfect segue into our final three questions, which are, have you gotten a piece of advice, either really good or really bad, that has stuck with you?
I'm certain that I have. Let me find one. I actually had this conversation somewhat recently, and I will make sure that the person who shared it with me listens to this. His name is Boris. And I remember so distinctly when I was transitioning to acrobatic coach, I took a hiatus from casting and I was acrobatic coach at Cirque du Soleil. And then eventually I returned back to casting. In any case, he said to me, everything's fine when everything's fine. So simple and so much to, pardon me, gotta drink my water. So much to unpack in that. Everything's fine when everything's fine. Yeah, don't be fooled. It's not always going to be easy and coasting and just like it is. That is where you really need to get into the anticipatory state of mind and the agility state of mind, the notion perhaps of being embracing equanimity. Get ready for things to not be fine, because it's easy when it's fine. It's when it's not fine that you are really put to the test.
100%. Even when it is fine, sometimes you don't realize that it's
not. Unless you have anticipatory anxiety like I do, and then you're always anticipating the worst. And then it's like, everything is actually okay right now. Let's remember this moment.
We just need to find that balance between the anticipatory anxiety and like temper the anxiety part of that. And then also bolster the mindfulness, be present, be ready to accept that it is, be ready to accept that you can't change it, but it still is. So yep. Get over it, but don't let that be an excuse for not being ready to get into the trenches when things are less fine.
Totally.
Okay, so second question. For somebody who's discovering circus or is a fan of circus, a circus student, is there a book, a movie, a TV show, a circus show, just some kind of art reference that you love that you would recommend to somebody else, ideally circus related?
Well, not to suck up or anything, but your podcast is doing a pretty fine job. I mean, I really am so pleased to be on this roster of all-stars because you look back through all the different episodes and there is a tremendous range of really awesome people that you've spoken with. So I'm going to just keep that as my final answer. The broader answer, though, there are so many forms of inspiration. I would actually step out of the circus arena and say to a circus performer, look outside your bubble and then interpret that to bring it back in. There are some amazing, inspirational, creative things. I can't even name what those things are. I mean, they are just, it's literally, it can be visual art. It can be performing art. It can be whatever genre of performing art. It could be the power of music, whatever those things are that are outside of you. It can be nature. It can be a bird singing in nature that could be so deeply inspirational to generate some sort of little germ of an idea for a new development of an act or a longer show. Inspiration is everywhere. And I think the important muscle to flex is how to be receiving it and then how to interpret it for what your own goals are.
Right.
I love that. I was just thinking about the Circus Days and Nights. I don't know if you watched that, but it was opera with circus with, you know, and David Henry Wang, who's an amazing playwright, and you have Philip Glass, who's, you know, a genius composer, and like seeing all those come together was such an interesting collaboration. It was definitely different than I was thinking it was going to be, just knowing like David Henry Wang's work. And, you know, it wasn't exactly what I was thinking it was going to be, but I loved seeing all those different art forms come together in a way that wasn't what I was imagining, you know?
You imagine it more fast paced and exciting?
Yeah.
Lindsay's not saying that she didn't like it, which is what she actually thinks.
I mean, there was like beautiful parts of it, but I was like, okay.
It's all right. If you make it this far, it's all right if we tell you what you're thinking.
Let's get the pace going a little bit. But you know, it's a perfect example of all those different like different art forms coming together and inspiring something, you know, different and new. I just wanted to see the teeter board act like in its entirety. Like Aaron, what's the last name?
Hakala
is so amazing on teeter board. I just want to watch a teeter board. You know, there's something also good about just being able to watch an amazing act and not have all the fluff around it and just watch it. And that's, you know, that's my critique.
I do hear you. And it's almost like this, I lean so heavily into acrobatics. It's my first love and I love everything about it. So I do share that occasionally. I'm like, let's just get to the meat of it. But actually, I also really love this notion of being challenged, that when something is integrated well, that is such a huge win. When I can be really enjoying everything that leads up to it and everything that leads out of it, that for me is a hugely successful show. Because that is actually one of the ID and about like identity challenges of circus, letting it be able to become, I think, more mature beyond spectacle. Beyond just the wow. I love the wow. I won't deny it. I live in the wow place. I love all the acrobatics. But there's so much more potential. And really what you're speaking of, I think, is where we're headed. It's the future of circus.
Yeah, I'm excited to see, you know, we talk a lot about the transition of these, you know, quote unquote terms of traditional and contemporary circus and how they kind of don't really mean much now, but they definitely put anchors in the minds of people. And then like, where is that going? And what is the newest immersion of circus, especially after this pandemic? Like, that's what I'm most excited to see. Like, where do we go after this year and a half of nothing? And you know, where are the new lines kind of snaking around So anyway, our last question, I could talk about that for hours. Our last question is, who do you think we should have on our podcast?
I always knew that question was coming, of course, because I've listened to your podcast. You'd think I would have come up with a more prescribed answer. I'm a little partial to the young dreamer. And I think it would be really fun to get inside the head of someone who is, you know, maybe just barely pushing double digits, but who's already made the decision that circus is going to be their life.
I mean, like an 11-year-old.
Yeah. Someone who has everything ahead of them and nothing but passion for what they do. And I could throw a couple names at you, but I won't do it live or in recording form. But I love that notion of going to the beginning of the pathway.
I love that.
Yeah. Like get inside their head. What is it about circus?
Man, I dread the things I would have said had somebody asked me that when I was 11. There's a documentary about Circus Mercus called, I forget what it's called, but it was documented in 2005. I think I joined the tour part of Smirkus in 2006, and all of my friends who are in the 2005 documentary have like regrettable things they said on camera. Like,
yeah, but that was people who didn't know about circus, right? We'd be interviewing from the knowledge of asking appropriate questions.
I think so too. That's a nice idea though. Nobody suggested that. So I think, getting a kid who's very excited about it. You know, we've had people on who have been doing circus since they were a kid, but not necessarily from that from that point of view. So that's a very clever idea.
Yeah, we definitely should do that.
Well, Stacey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking with us. Best of luck with your new journey with Circus Talk. We'll certainly be keeping an eye out on all the developments. I'm sure talking about it on the pre-show as cool things get dropped. And hope to see you in person at one of these, you know, don't need to Zoom forever. Hopefully, eventually, we'll all be back in the same room seeing shows and looking for artists.
My thanks to both of you. And let's make the live in-person thing happen for real. It's coming.
And that was our interview with Stacey Clark.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@highwaycircus.com.
Don't forget to get your tickets to Beyond Babel and Stars Above. You can get those through our website, highwaycircus.com. And if you use the code podcast at checkout, you'll get a sneaky little discount.
Have a good weekend.
Hope to see you at one of the shows.
Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.